8-1046, State v. Outagamie County Board of Adjustment. This case was first heard last term, and we asked for additional briefs and then put this on for oral argument again and posed particular questions to counsel. So we will first hear from Richard J. Carlson, representing David and Barbara Warning.
Morning, may it please the court. I'm Richard Carlson. I'm representing the respondents petitioners, David and Barbara Warning. As noted, the court asked the parties to address in particular two questions at oral argument. And the first question is, what is the impact, if any, of Statute 8731G on NR 116.13 sub 2? 8731G prohibits DNR from promulgating any rule or imposing any restriction that results in an ordinance or other regulation containing provisions for flood-proof basements that are more restrictive than those imposed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. A clear directive to DNR. A message to DNR from the legislature that we don't want you imposing more restrictions than that required by the federal government. NR 116.13.2 is a rule imposing a restriction, as contemplated by 8731G, that prohibits a variance to allow a basement floor below the regional flood elevation. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has substantive regulations, and those substantive regulations for basements are found in CFR 60.3C2. FEMA requires basement floors to be at or above the regional flood elevation. So does DNR. DNR's restriction is not greater than what FEMA requires. But in CFR 60.6, FEMA authorizes variances from the requirements set forth in 60.3. 60.6A says, the community, after examining an applicant's hardship, shall approve or disapprove a request for a variance. 60.6A3 states the standard for approving a request, and basically, the standard used by FEMA is an exceptional hardship. There is no distinction between use or area. It is an exceptional hardship standard. There is no exemption in the FEMA authorization for a variance for any particular substantive requirement of FEMA that goes with basements, that goes with river floodplains, ocean floodplains. There is no exception in the FEMA authorization for a variance for not giving a variance for any substantive regulation.
Council, let me just interrupt you for a moment. Let's put this case in context. Your clients have built a home. That house does not, that house has a basement below the, remind me what the terminology.
Regional flood elevation.
Pardon me?
Regional flood elevation.
Regional flood elevation. Okay. And now they wanted to build a sun porch. And they can't get a permit for the sun porch because the house is non-conforming because the basement is below the regional flood elevation, right?
The house is illegal.
House
not
is
non-conforming, it's
okay.
Illegal.
And so now they want a variance to make it legal, right?
To legitimize it, to make it not illegal.
All right. So they want this this variance. Then if they get the variance to legitimize the house, they will then be eligible for a sun porch.
Correct.
Permit, okay? That's the stage. All right. Now, is this a flood-proof residential basement?
No.
Then why are we under 8731GA, since that results in ordinance containing provisions for flood-proof residential basements?
Basically, the flood-proofing, as it's used, that terminology is used, can mean two things. Number one, flood-proof means being up above the flood, and there's another aspect of flood-proofing, and that is putting in certain tiles and having cement that's impermeable.
But there's a legal definition that if it's within a certain area, then you can get away with the elevation because, and you flood-proof it. Isn't that, I'm drawing back, way back in my memory about the case. I'm sorry. Is that what you mean by the one of those elements?
By what 8730 means? Well, flood-proof,
it doesn't mean that you got the tiles on the basement.
Not necessarily, correct. Flood-proof could mean the elevation.
That's right. And if you come within a certain range, even if you're below flood protection elevation, if you're in that 2 point something or other, then you can flood-proof it. Isn't that correct?
No, you have to be, to flood-proof it, my recollection is to flood-proof it, you have to be, the regulations require that your lowest floor be 2 feet above the regional flood elevation.
Okay.
And if you are at the regional flood elevation, you are allowed to flood-proof.
Right, right.
But if you are below the regional flood elevation, you cannot.
That's right. So why isn't 1G, doesn't apply to this case because you're not within that area? Because you're below regional flood elevation.
Why does 8730 apply?
8731G says the department may not promulgate any rule or impose any restriction that does any of the following. A, results in an ordinance containing provisions for flood-proofed residential basements that are more restrictive. And you're saying that 112 is more restrictive.
Yes.
Than is allowed under 1GA, and I'm saying to you, you don't come under that because you're not within the definition of flood-proofed residential basements.
Because flood-proofed, as it's used in the terminology of floodplain regulations, flood-proof also means being raised above. You've got basically one option. As a matter of fact, a limited option. First, you have to be above the flood protection elevation, which is 2 feet above the regional flood,
right.
And that is referred to as flood proofing.
Right. And you're not.
And then there is another aspect that if you are at the flood protection elevation,
right?
Well, you wouldn't need to flood proof. The other is if you are at the flood. Regional flood elevation, you can flood-proof to the equivalent of the 2 feet above.
Okay, but
the flood-proofing means, in the vernacular of floodplain zoning, protecting your basement or your house against floods by either raising it or doing something else.
Now, just putting in more fill would do, I mean, right, just raising it.
Would be flood-proofing.
But... So you're saying you are a flood-proof residential basement. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying we are required to be a flood-proof residential basement, but we are not.
Okay, so...
At least up to a certain level. We're like I think 5 feet too low.
Yes. It's at least arguable that you, because you're not a flood-proof residential basement, you don't come under 1GA. It's arguable. Maybe it's not. That
arguable.
Away, but not a good argument. As far as you're concerned.
Not in my opinion, no.
Right. Okay.
Somewhat hair-splitting.
So you would just... this would be better for you if it didn't have that. It would just be better for you if it said, results in an ordinance or other regulation containing provisions for residential basements that are more restrictive than those imposed. That's how you're reading that statute. You're just eliminating the words, the word floodproof. Do you want it read for residential basements?
I am not ignoring it because, like I said, in floodplain administration, it is extremely rare that anybody even does floodproofing. The protection and what is referred to as floodproofing, 99.999% of the time is elevating it. And that's the essence, that's the direction. Floodproofing, what you're talking about, is like a something where if you can't do the elevation, there's this last-ditch effort. But floodproofing, as used in floodplain regulation, means elevation, the ultimate floodproof.
So it reads, this would read the same with or without that word, the way you read it?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I want to know.
The, as I mentioned, the FEMA standard has an exceptional hardship standard for a variance. And the court asked for some authority on that. I don't have a case directly on point with respect to the issue precisely before the court, but I did find some New York cases that in their floodplain ordinances, they incorporate, by reference, a standard for variances that's found in CFR 60.6. They authorize the board to grant a variance consistent with the standards in 60.6. And a case I have on that is, let's see where my site is. In re Round Dune, Inc. versus Crooklyn, 155, Appellate Division 2nd, 668, 547, New York State 2nd, 894. At issue was the denial of a variance for a dune setback in a tidal floodplain district. And that purpose of that regulation was to minimize hazards resulting from the flooding of a beach caused by coastal storms and hurricanes. This was the town of Southampton in New York. The Board of Appeals was authorized to give variances with the following provision. The Board of Appeals shall hear and decide appeals and requests for a variance from the requirements of this section, consistent with the standards of Section 60.6 of the Rules and Regulations of the National Flood Insurance Program, 44 CFR 60. Suggesting that, again, there's no limitation contemplated by FEMA on the grant of a variance for any substantive regulation. CFR 60.6 authorizes variances for basement elevation requirements in CFR 60.3. There is no limitation for a variance as to any substantive standard. NR 116.13.2 prohibits variances for basement elevations. NR 116.13.2 is a rule of restriction that results in a regulation containing provisions for floodproofing basements that are more restrictive than FEMA. And NR 116.13.2 is prohibited by 8731G. State claims that under CFR 60.6, a variance can only be given if the FEMA administrator grants a community-wide exception. That claim is incorrect. A variance is an apple, an exception is an orange. An exception applies to the whole community. That's given by FEMA. A variance is on a property-by-property basis. That is administered and granted by the community itself, not FEMA, pursuant to the authorization in 60.6.
So the point is that the exception would be, as I think stated in the facts, the town village of Shiocton, which got an entire...
Correct. Right. The Village of Shiocton has a community-wide exception from the substantive standards of the floodplain regs. I don't know if it's across the board on all the substantive standards, but it does have a community-wide exception. Conceivably, it would be conceivable if it wasn't across the board, that you could still get a variance, you might need a variance, and it would be administered by the Village Board of Appeals for a regulation that maybe was not accepted, that you couldn't meet.
Counsel?
In looking at your brief, obviously one of your arguments is that we should readdress the Kenosha County case that was decided by this court in 1997. I understand that part of your argument is, the argument is the test that is set in the Kenosha County case you advance is not the appropriate test for area differences. What's the test in Kenosha? What is our test that was established in the Kenosha County case?
As I understand it, and as it's been interpreted, the test for all variances, whether it's an area or use variance, is whether in the absence of a variance, no feasible or reasonable use can be made of the property.
Can the Warings meet that test in this case? No reasonable use of the property?
The Court of Appeals in this case talked about no feasible use of the land. I argued in my initial brief it should be no reasonable use of the property. It's a tough call. Potentially, yes. Arguably, yes.
And what's the argument that they can meet the test that's established?
Because if you can't use your house or you have to fill in your basement, you are being denied, so to speak, reasonable use of your property. If it's reasonable use of your land, I don't think they can meet it.
If they can meet the reasonable use test set forth in Kenosha County, or arguably can, I mean, that's what people are here for all the time, arguing, you know, there's few certainties that are presented to this court in terms of attorneys at oral argument. If they arguably can or can meet the reasonable use test, then why are you asking us to overturn our holding in Kenosha County?
Because I still don't think it's a workable or appropriate test. I don't. It's been described as an incorrect test. I don't know if it's so much an incorrect as I don't think it's good policy, and I don't think it's workable. And I've given you examples. The variance is a necessary evil in zoning, and the no reasonable use test would virtually eliminate variances as a tool in zoning. There are, like I said in my initial brief, you draft the zoning ordinance kind of on a plane of what is desired. There are some properties which you know that might not meet all the standards, and you can allow, through the use of a variance, some custom fitting to that. I've given an example of retrofitting a warehouse into upscale apartments. I can give you another example. My neighbor got a variance from the garage setback from 4 feet to 3 feet. I live in a neighborhood that was built in the 1930s. Everybody had a one-car garage. Recently, there's been a spate of people putting in two and two-and-a-half-car garages, updating the neighborhood. The standard now seems to be three cars. Two-car garages are going up. Two-car garage, you couldn't make the clearance in the driveway between his house. The city of Appleton gave him a variance. Can't do that anymore. And there is a public purpose. There is a need for that kind of fitting, for that kind of adjusting,
I don't
think is allowed under this current standard.
I don't understand this. You know, this court, as all appellate courts too, takes seriously the doctrine of stare decisis, the doctrine of precedent. This case was decided, referring to Kenosha County, 2 years ago. Unanimous decision, I guess it was
97,
wasn't it?
98, I believe.
Okay. 2 years ago.
One of the things that concerns me is that our principle of law, stare decisis, is based on the law that's going to change, is going to change incrementally. It doesn't mean that it can never change, but it's to change only incrementally, not simply because judges have changed their minds. Now, I heard you say that arguably you can meet the test. I don't know if you can or not, but arguably, those are your words. If there's an argument to be made, a reasonable argument to be made that you can make the test, why should we undo unanimous precedent of recent unanimous precedent? You advance it's because of it's not a good idea. So I need help in that because it really is contrary
because
to what I think the role of courts is about.
Well, if you look at the 1998 decision, you look at also the previous 70 years of decision history on a variance, and I think of the Taylor-Hoffer versus Patrie. That was kind of one of the first ones that came up. There was a need for a foot or two for a porch stoop, and the court, the variance was challenged, and the court just said matter-of-factly, almost saying that this is so obvious we don't even need to do citations. The Board of Adjustment, or Board of Appeals in that case, is authorized to waive exact compliance with some dimension, some detail of the ordinance. And that has basically been Wisconsin law all the way up to 1998, at least for an area variance. And the court's decision in 1998 substantially changed it. And I think that's reflected in a concurring opinion in Spinner versus Kenosha County, basically saying, you guys, that the Board of Appeals is out of business. And I don't know if that was intended by the court, but I think that's the consequence and the result. And I, having been a planner for 8 years, looked at the variance as somewhat of a necessary evil and being a student of zoning, and plus the fact I think the court is the one that asked me to address the standard. I didn't. I said arguably that we could meet the standard, but it was the court who asked the question whether the standard was correct.
And
my response is
What was your position in your first brief, Mr.
My position in the first brief was that I could meet the... Basically, that my position in the first brief was I could meet the no reasonable use standard, not the way the Court of Appeals set it for the land, but I could meet it for the property. In other words, no reasonable use for land, you could always look at butterflies or birds on it. But I thought that I met it for the property, if you include the house.
If the house was not usable, if they said that it
would have to be modified at great expense
to fill in the basement.
Right.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, what is the standing of county boards of adjustment following the Kenosha case?
The standing.
That's not the right word. What are the implications for county boards of adjustment after the Kenosha case?
I think there's two things. Number one is that if the word is getting out that a variance would be futile, and the second thing I think of consequence of it wasn't just the Kenosha County case, but there was a couple before that, is that, for example, the counties that aren't even defending the boards of adjustment anymore. I hear on the cases State versus Outagamie County, and there's no counsel here appearing for Outagamie County. They're just letting the property owner defend. They're not even wasting their time defending any variance anymore. So it for all, you know, and it's not an old, and it's not an exaggeration, but for all practical purposes, the Board of Adjustment is out of business. And if they made a decision, they're kind of like out on their own.
Were there any legislative changes that preceded Kenosha County that would justify that effect?
No. The authorization for a variance has been exactly the same in 59, 694, 7 for whatever, 50 years.
Wouldn't the question be contrary that after Kenosha, the legislatures had 2 years to take a look at that, wouldn't they have considered that and determined that perhaps the court was not correct or made it too exacting or failed to give consideration to the impact it had on the workers?
I think to the extent that they're up on developments, they might think that this case would be the decisive factor about whether or not they have to amend it. Speaking of 59.694.7, though, there is an interesting provision in 59.694.
What statute? Can you repeat that?
59.694.7, that the legislature says, under the powers of the boards, to grant special exceptions and variances for renewable energy resource systems. And I ask a rhetorical question, how could the Board of Adjustment now give any variance for a renewable energy resource system under the reasonable use standard? I mean, you can always burn coal, you can always burn wood, you could burn the furniture. No reasonable use. They will not be, by the standard for a variance, there will not be an opportunity to authorize a variance for the purpose of facilitating solar energy or other alternative forms of energy. You will have to go to the Board of Adjustment and you will have to say, I've got no reasonable use of my property in the absence of a variance.
Justice Prosser has another question. Justice
Prosser. I was trying to follow the colloquy between the Chief Justice and you, Mr. Carlson. And the Chief Justice asked you if the warnings property was flood-proofed. And you said it was not.
Correct.
And you, I think you argued that the primary means of flood-proofing was elevation.
Correct.
But I thought I heard you say something about tiling. Is it possible to flood-proof this basement by some means other than elevation at this point in time?
No. Not by law, because flood-proofing by these other methods, you must be at the regional flood elevation. The warnings are 3 feet below the regional flood elevation, and they are 5 feet below the regional flood protection elevation. Basements are supposed to be, there's a measure of protection of 2 feet, so they're supposed to be 2 feet above the regional flood elevation, and that's why I say that this 8731G is such a narrow option. And second of all, and when I say a narrow option because it's only for that 2 feet of area, it's also a narrow option because generally it's a heck of a lot more expensive to floodproof by quote mechanical means than by elevation.
If you were originally building,
yes,
you would just build it above the that elevation. And that's why I asked you the question, because floodproofed, and your response to it, and Justice Brass makes it clear, floodproofed is a technical term that has a special meaning here. It doesn't just mean tiling. It may mean tiling if you're in a certain area.
Well, it has to have certain concrete that withstands the pressure of the water and a host of other things. And it
within a certain range in the ground.
It's only an option for a very, very narrow band, an extremely narrow, to the point that, you could probably, in Ottawa County, there probably hasn't been something flood-proofed in the 20 years since these regulations have been imposed.
That is a variance already. That is, flood-proofing is a variance from the concept of where the building should be. It's a 2 feet variance. Well, I'm not using variance in a technical sense. The rule is you got to do X But if you're going to build in the Y area, you can do something else.
Extraordinary.
Right, okay. Any other questions? Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. We will now hear from the Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Kubrishek. I'm Assistant Attorney General for the state of Wisconsin, the plaintiff appellant to this appeal. The two issues that were identified by the court and the court's questions this morning and counsel's arguments strongly suggest the need to focus heavily on the language of the statutes and the regulations and the ordinances that are really concerned with this case. And that is because with regard to that first issue, I, like Mr. Carlson, found no case law that really addresses that question. And with the second question before the court, I did find a regulation that suggests that in a floodplain zoning case, we shouldn't be talking about the differences between use variances and area variances, and that was ordinances and regulations which were not previously cited to the court. That's why I provided the court with copies of those ordinances and regulations that I would be relying on in today's argument. Back in February, when the court asked us to address the eight issues that concern questions the court had, the question that was initially asked by the court was kind of broad. It was, what impact, if any, does 8731G have on 116? And in doing that, the state focused on the words rules or prohibitions. And so simply the state in its brief only made reference to the fact that there was the broad rule that you not have basements below the regional flood elevation, and that the federal rule was the same and the state rule was the same. And the state also focused on the community-wide exemptions that we don't really have in this case. It doesn't apply to that.
Two is not an issue.
Correct. And so today's argument is quite different than what I have in my brief, because I'm focusing on that variance aspect and whether or not the fact that the state prohibits variances, is that more strict than the federal government? And the state strongly submits that it is not, and it's not for three reasons. The first reason.
May I ask you a question?
Sure.
Where does the state get the authority to have Administrative Rule 116.13 sub 2?
That is detailed in, I believe it's the third argument of my brief. I go back to the enabling legislation that allowed the DNR to promulgate rules for floodplain zoning. Off the top of my head, I cannot relate to you that exact legislation, although I can tell you it is quoted in my brief in that argument.
There's another language, maybe you can help me with that, that indicates that, I think it's that the counties have authority to regulate, except if there's a public policy against it. Parenthetical comment.
But
I mean, to get into
the language I did cite in my brief specifically states that the DNR shall promulgate rules to regulate floodplain zoning regulation, or to regulate construction activities in floodplains.
Well, is there anything in 8730 that says there is a class of cases where no variance can be granted?
There's nothing like that in 8730, no, that suggests the DNR cannot promulgate rules that prohibit variances in floodplain zoning areas.
You say there's nothing in 8730 that prohibits the DNR from making that?
Correct.
Yeah. But is there anything in the statute that authorizes? Because there's a statute that authorizes variances. And you say, in this class of cases, there can't be variances.
The DNR regulation says that. The DNR, remember that this court has held, I believe it was in the Winnebago County case, that when the legislature directs the DNR to specifically promulgate rules for a specific area, those rules have the force of law because the legislature, through committee, approves those rules. And basically, the legislature delegates to the DNR to determine what the community needs in terms of specific rules, in this case, in floodplain zoning areas. And so that has the force of law.
You cannot have an administrative loop, rule that contradicts a statute. You cannot have one. Notwithstanding the administrative law committee and all the process in the legislature, there's only one way to make law.
Well, let me ask you, let me point out that in terms of the legislation that enables counties to grant variances, it's a very general item of legislation. It covers many, many areas. It doesn't just involve floodplain zoning. It's shoreland zoning. It's aesthetic setbacks. It's extremely broad. In terms of the legislator's direction to the DNR, or delegation of the DNR, to specify which rules ought to apply in floodplain zoning areas, it's basically saying to the DNR, you set the community standards for the states. Yes, we have that very general variance area where counties can grant variances, and that language is very general. But the specific language of the DNR is you enact rules to regulate floodplain zoning areas. You determine, DNR, what should be that community standard, the community standard that you can't step over. And then the DNR, with very good and strong justifiable purposes, in floodplain zoning areas have said no variances for that. And that is the community standard, and there's good purposes behind it. In a shoreland zoning area, nobody dies, nobody gets hurt. The shoreland zoning is designed to protect the environment, but nobody dies, nobody gets hurt. In a floodplain zoning situation, you can have a flood, the basement collapses because of the hydraulic pressure, and the house collapses. People get hurt. People drowned in floods. You have the problem with electrical appliances, which cause electrocution. The legislature has delegated to the DNR to set those standards. The DNR has set those standards with great reason and great purpose. Something that, in the Kenosha County case, essentially upholds the standard of unreasonable use for the property based on the important purpose behind the regulation itself.
Given the passion of your answer, sir, I assume that you want to fill in the basement.
I want the basement flood-proofed. And contrary to what Mr. Carlson says, there's a number of ways.
Council, you'll have to stand in front of the microphone because you're being recorded.
I apologize. I always do that. I brought with me today a FEMA document, Homeowner's Guide to Retrofitting, 6 Ways to Protect Your House from Flooding. One of the methods is elevating the basement, essentially moving the house probably to another foundation. Another way is wet-proofing a basement, and this is one that I never even heard of. What you essentially do is you reinforce the walls. Well, actually, you don't need to do that for this one. For wet-proofing, you allow the water to come in the basement. You move the utilities to a higher level, so there's no danger to individuals from the utilities, but you allow the water to come in the basement during a flood, and that way the walls won't collapse. It's called wet flood proofing. Then, of course, there's relocation to a safe area, adding fill, that type of thing. There's also what's called dry flood proofing. I don't know if that would apply here, but in that set of circumstances, you build a basement that has a rubber liner underneath it, and then you also have to have reinforced walls so the hydraulic pressure doesn't crush the basement and keeps the water out.
Well, why are we, what difference does that make? Does that mean that if there was an enforcement action to fill in this basement, that a court in equity would enjoin that and say just wet proof it? I mean,
it could. It would have those options. Again, under the Good case, Forest County versus Good, it would have many options to it. It would have the options of bringing deputies and doing nothing.
Is that why you're telling us this about wet proofing?
No, I was responding to Justice Prosser's question where he said the only answer is basically tearing down the house, I believe.
Okay. Well,
raising the house exclusion.
Here's what I'm getting at, counsel. I re-listened to the argument from a year ago, and I listened to your argument now, and you speak with passion about the real risk to human life from having basements in the floodplain.
Right.
And this particular basement is in the floodplain. It seems to me you cannot square the passion with which you speak with non-action. In other words, I don't think you can say, if you win this case, well, now we're not going to enforce this.
I'm not saying that we will not enforce that. I never said that. I said, one, the determination
the trouble I'm having is squaring your passion with the fact that the community a half a mile away has permission to have basements below where the warnings are, even though they're in the flood fringe, and that there are other houses up and down the street that have that too, and that I think you claim, well, we'll enforce it if we want to, and we won't if we won't, if we don't. I mean, I can't square that with your passion.
Well, Justice Prosser, I can point you to the fact that in the Federal Code of Regulations 606 or 60.6, there's very strict and detailed requirements and criteria that a community must establish before FEMA, before they will grant that community-wide exemption. I don't know what the particular application of, I guess what might, maybe you're talking about Shockton, what that looked like, what justifications they had for that community grant-wide exemption. But reading that regulation, it becomes very apparent that there are strict standards that a community must meet. It can't be just that you come in there and say, hey, we want an exemption, why don't you give it to us? I presume that there were scientific studies done to show that damaging that particular area would not be great because of a flood, for this reason, and this reason. Or that in that area, the floodwaters will not move in fast, or that there isn't substantial development in those areas. We're just talking about a few farmhouses. But I just don't know what the facts of that situation are.
Well,
but there would be strict criteria.
Now, let's just double back for a minute. We have two questions here. One, 8730. Is this house a flood-proof residential basement under 1G?
No, it is not, Your Honor. And that,
do you agree with Mr. Carlson's definition of flood-proofed, which he talked about that 2+ feet?
Yes,
we are authorized to
there flood-proof. Is that regional flood elevation and then the flood protection elevation, which is higher. I agree with that, his characterization with that. That's simply the law. Ironically, I had three reasons why there is no conflict between state law and federal law. And Justice Abramson, you stole my thunder. My second reason is that this statute doesn't apply because we're not talking about a flood-proof basement here. I mean, what the regulation, that regulation, of the subpart A of 8730 essentially says is DNR, the federal government, has certain criteria for concluding that a house is flood-proofed. DNR, you can't have more stringent criteria. Once the federal government says the house is flood-proofed, the DNR can't say, no, that's not good enough. It prohibits the DNR from having more strict rules for flood-proof basements. We don't have a flood-proof basement here. If we did, we wouldn't have an application for a variance, I don't think. Although this house is actually below the flood protection elevation, so it may be there.
That's number which argument, 1, 2, or 3?
That was number two. Number one is that, keep in mind, FEMA doesn't grant variances. FEMA recognizes variances granted by the community. So you have to look at the definition of what the word community means. This is, again, something that I didn't argue in my brief because I didn't think it was necessary. And it's, again, a section of the Code of Federal Regulations that I didn't cite. 59.1 defines community as the state or a political subdivision thereof. Well, in this state, in this situation, the state as a community, looking at for the welfare of its citizens, has said no variances. Insofar as it did that, the community has spoken. The federal government recognizes the state of Wisconsin acting as a community, making a determination that there can be no variances for flood-proof, floodplain zoning regulations. That's probably the most important one because the language allows this to happen.
Is it constitutional to do that?
I beg your pardon?
Is it constitutional to do that?
I believe it is.
Why?
Because, I mean, it's simply the state in this set of circumstances, for purposes of FEMA, they determine that they'll allow the state to determine the standards, or the local community, the county or the municipality or the city, to determine the standards. They're open to whoever gets to determine the standards, so to speak.
I guess my question is it constitutional to take an entire class of cases out of the variance procedure entirely, which this DNR rule does, right? Just no variances at all.
It does, for flood-proof basements. Again, I believe it is. I can't think of a reason why it wouldn't be constitutional.
Well, is there a rational basis for making this distinction?
Absolutely. I think there is, because we're talking about floodplain zoning as opposed to a perfect example would be the garage that Mr. Carlson was talking about, built next to his house. There's a strong purpose to have no variances for floodplain areas, as opposed to variances for the garage next to his house, which basically is aesthetic-based variance. I can't see why it wouldn't be constitutional.
Well, isn't the variance procedure a necessary safeguard against, or to make zoning ordinances generally constitutional, to avoid any takings arguments?
I think that is an argument, but I think what you need to do is, and this almost kind of gets to the second issue, the issue of amicus brief, that amicus brief poses. Essentially, amicus brief recognizes that there are some, what I would call, less important zoning regulations that might merit a standard lower than no reasonable use of the property. And you know, I can't necessarily even disagree with that. And again, Mr. Carlson's circumstances with the garage, that supports that. And I think this court's decision in Kenosha County supports it, because the court said for areas, variances in flood and shoreland zone cases, we need that higher standard because of that important purpose behind the regulation. But what amicus has done, and what your question suggests, is should we throw the baby out with the bathwater just because we need a lower standard for what I would call the less significant areas of regulation, the garages, the aesthetic thing, the aesthetic aspect of it? And I say absolutely not. We need to stick to the facts of this case. I mean, the important aspect of the case is the fact that we're protecting lives here. Do you lower the standard for protecting lives just because you want to lower the standard for that aesthetic variance? I submit you don't do that. You don't do it in the courts. What you do is you go to the legislature and say, hey, this is unreasonable. We can't have this high standard for aesthetic side yard setbacks. And that's the solution. It's not to do it in this court and basically gut the protection that floodplain zoning regulations have for the people of the state.
Mr. Gabuschek, I'm as I listen to you, I understand that you are reading the Kenosha County case to say that the test for a variance is somehow different for some dimensional variances, some area variances. That isn't the way I read the case. I mean, where do you get that? And then,
no.
If I'm wrong,
you're wrong.
Where is the line? What are the some that have a different test than the others?
I submit to you Your Honor, that the only thing Kenosha County says is that for area variances in shoreland zoning cases, the standard is no reasonable use. I would also submit that that's the standard for floodplain zoning. I believe it does apply to all areas. As we sit today, for area variances, and it expressly doesn't address use variances, but clearly for area variances, it does say that. But I'm submitting to you that this case doesn't present a justification for lowering that standard, because the facts of this case, indeed, you know, as I mentioned before, are in the floodplain zoning area, the purpose for the regulations in floodplain zoning is more important than those probably in shoreland zoning. So would you take this case and decide to lower the standard? I submit that should not be done. This isn't the case involving the garage and the side yard setback. The facts aren't here.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Is there anything else besides floodplain and shoreland where you say Kenosha County hasn't changed the law on area variances?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that Kenosha County didn't change the law. It absolutely didn't. You know, ironically, I have been an environmental attorney for 10 years. And from day one, in any case I've had, and to my knowledge, any case the Department of Justice has, it has argued that when you determine unnecessary hardship, you have to evaluate whether or not there is going to be a reasonable use for the property. And if there is not, there is no use. And that was based on a reading of the Andorfer case, the Schneider case, the Markdale case, and then most recently, two or three years ago, the Winnebago County case. The state has been making the argument of the no reasonable use standard for the last 10 years in all the trial courts. It was not until the Court of Appeals reversed the Kenosha County case, to my knowledge, and again, I only have a limited amount. I don't know if every case our department has, but I do know the cases I've had, that a court didn't apply the no reasonable use standard. This isn't anything new.
Well, I used to sit on the Fox Point Board of Zoning Appeals 15 years ago, and we always treated use variances differently from area variances.
Okay.
So, you know, for what it's worth, local boards of appeal treated them as two different things, subject to two different sorts of standards, because of the difference between zoning ordinances that regulate use and zoning ordinances that regulate area issues.
I know we're jumping around here, but your question raised another issue why I believe this court need not even address the difference between area and use variances in this case. Again, it stems from a regulation that I have not previously cited to the court. It's one that I provided the court. During the research for this oral argument, the state learned that not only state regulation, but county regulations prohibit the granting of use variances in floodplain zoning cases. When, if you look at NR 116.21.4E, it states that variances shall not have the effect of allowing or expanding a use or structure that is prohibited in the zoning district. That's a use variance. You cannot expand or allow a use that's not authorized by the zoning district. Use variances are very, you can draw an analogy between being allowed to put in a convenience store with residential zoning. That's a use variance. Wisconsin Administrative Code 116.21.4E prohibits that use variance in floodplain zoning cases. Ironically, Outagamie County follows that same language in its Outagamie County Shoreland Shoreland Wetland Ordinance 1640.4E. It mimics the language. Shall not have the effect of allowing or expanding a use or structure which is prohibited in the zoning district. I did some research quickly when this came up, and I found out that 68 of the 71 counties have adopted similar such language. Not exactly, the same language. Some of them expressly say no use variances.
Well, some is this a use variance or an area variance that
we're talking about? Use variance. Okay. And so my point was, with regard to Justice Sykes and with regard to the rest of the court questioned what's the differences between and should there be differences between. I'm suggesting that in this case, we don't even need to address that, because we can't have use variances in floodplain zoning cases.
If you're saying that the basement here is a use variance?
No, I've never said that. Well, I have to take it back. No. I don't think, I didn't mean to if I did. Let me back up a little bit.
Certainly there can be a house here if it's the proper elevation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I looked at it in answering the court.
Why cite the use variance provisions you just cited?
The reason I'm saying that is one of the court's questions is what's the difference between area and use variances? And what I'm saying is that question is somewhat only theoretical in this case, because the facts don't even support that analysis, or at least the law doesn't support the analysis, because we can't have use variances in floodplain zoning cases.
Okay. But this is an area variance.
This is an area variance, right.
I think this is a hybrid, to be honest.
Okay. Don't cut.
Thank you so much for that. If I can have the opportunity to explain it, I'd appreciate it.
How can we deny that?
No.
Sometimes I get a little worked up.
Okay.
As I mentioned, use variances are kind of clear, that you're using a use not authorized by the zoning aspect of it. The other type of variance is the area variance, where people have said, if you can measure it, it's an area variance. This is really a hybrid, because even though you can measure the flood elevation, what's important here is the use of the basement as a habitable section of the house, and the house as a habitable section. It's a hybrid. It's close to the Andorfer case, where the question was, the regulation prohibited holding tanks. Well, you can't measure a holding tank, so is it a use variance? Not really, because the zoning allowed residential use, and what we were talking about was residential use there. So it's a hybrid. That's my position.
Counsel, in a few moments, Amicus is going to argue, and I don't think, according to the schedule, you're going to have an opportunity to respond to Amicus. So I want to take a look at the second supplemental brief of the Amicus, and in large part, it addresses the Kenosha County case, indicating that Kenosha County should be abandoned in favor of the two-tiered variance procedure of Snyder, indicating we need a practical two-tiered variance procedure, indicating that Kenosha's no feasible use test is unconstitutional, and that it has effectively repealed 59694 sub 7. Would you address some of those issues?
I sure will, and I'll be glad to. To begin with, the standard that was articulated in Schneider, I don't believe was a two-tier standard, and I argue in my brief to the contrary. I believe that Schneider brought those together and basically concluded that there is going to be one standard, the no reasonable use standard, and the reason for that is because there was the aspect of uniformity and the importance of the statutes. I'll stand by that argument as set in my brief. In terms of the second issue of whether or not we should, why not grant that lower standard for variances? States admit that would be inadvisable by the court. The standard that is articulated by the Amicus brief, and I wanted to quote that standard exactly, would be a simple showing of unreasonable prevention of an owner from using this property for a permitted purpose, or compliance being unnecessarily burdensome. The state submits that is an unworkable low standard for areas of the law, and I'll admit my main focus today is my areas of the law, floodplain zoning and shoreland zoning. That standard is far too low for those two areas. We're talking protection of the environment, protection of health and safety of citizens. In terms of that standard, the warnings would have probably been granted a variance in this case, and I'm not sure that the state would have had a leg to stand on in terms of seeking review of that grant if that were the standard. Because they're zoned for residential living. Would the fact that they have to fill their basement impede that right of residential living? Would some people find that unreasonable, requiring them either to fill their basement to a level so it wasn't habitable or to move their house? Could people argue that that's unreasonable? I think they could. And if the board concluded that it was unreasonable, would the state being able to appeal that? I doubt it. That standard is simply too low, too easy for important areas that we're seeking to protect by the regulations we're talking about. You know, in the amicus brief, in right accord what you're talking about, they argue simply that, without, again, facts in the record, that currently boards of adjustment are granting variances because of a feasible use. They use the term feasible use, such as hiking or picnicking. And that if that were the case, that clearly all variances are being held to too high of a standard. You know, but under the reasonable use standard, what is the key word? It's reasonable. Would it be reasonable for the Board of Adjustment in this case to say to the Williams, hey, you've got 1.77 acres, you've got a reasonable use, you can hike and picnic out there. Would that be reasonable? Absolutely not. I don't think it would. But do the Williams have a reasonable use for the property? Absolutely. They can live on their house if they floodproof it. The warnings can also, you know, the evidence has shown in the record that they used to live on this property in a mobile home that had a floor elevated above the flood level. They filled the property above the flood level to put their mobile home on it. That was perfectly legal. They can use their property for that. They can even, you know, there's many, many options to the warnings. In terms of
expensive options.
They are options that do cost money. I can't deny that. But on the other hand, the law needs to be followed. Otherwise, if exceptions are simply made to the law, no one will follow the law. If exceptions are easy. And in this case, while the warnings may have to fill their basement, which would not be particularly expensive, move their utilities to do that, they need to do that in order for the law to be properly upheld and enforced. And that is the duty of both this court and the Department of Justice.
You had three issues on 1G, namely three arguments. One was the FEMA community. The second was this isn't a flood-proofed basement. What is the third? Maybe you said it on this one.
I will find that if I could just have one. Oh, yes. Okay, thank you for bringing that up and allowing me to comment on that. 66 A3, excuse me, 66 A1 through 7 sets forth the specific criteria that a board of adjustment must meet in order for FEMA to recognize that community's grant of a variance. And they're somewhat specific. The first one is that the lot should be smaller than 1/2 acre, although there is some what I would refer to as weasel words in that. And they do on occasion, they admit in that regulation itself, allow an exception for lots greater than 1/2 acre. The warnings in this case are nowhere near 1/2 acre or less. They're 1.77 acres. But there's also a requirement that the community, when they grant a variance, specifically address additional threats to public safety. They specifically address that the variance will not result in increased flood heights, and that they specifically address that the variance won't conflict with local laws.
That's all under 66A.
And And that didn't happen here. That didn't happen in this case. They never addressed those things.
Counsel, you pin, as I hear it, a lot of your argument on the authority of the DNA to promulgate rules and regulations. If you can find it while you're seated here, if not, when you leave the courtroom, I'd like you to send us.
I would be absolutely glad to do that.
Statute. Okay.
I would do that. In fact, I'm sure it's in my brief, and I believe I can find it because I reviewed it before.
That would be fine. And if you have to do it in writing, you'll send copies to opposing counsel. And
I would be glad to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gabrishek.
Thank you.
We will now hear from John Kastner, who represents the Wisconsin Builders Association, the Amicus Curiae.
Thank you, Justice Abrahams, and members of the court. May it please the court. My name is John Kastner. I'm an attorney with the Madison office of Brennan Style, based in McDougal. On behalf of the amicus, I'd like to thank the court for this extraordinary opportunity to participate in an issue that's of importance to the association. I have, as an attorney, been involved in a case in which a property owner has a lot on a lake 109 feet deep. That lot is subject to the 75-foot shoreline setback, and it's subject to a 50-foot road setback. Two setbacks overlap. They applied for a hardship variance, and the court, citing Kenosha, said, you can hike on it, you can have a picnic, you can sit on the shore and fish. You don't have a hardship. That's what Kenosha did.
When did your client buy that property?
Justice Babbage, there is case law in Wisconsin, the Shallow case, that says that a property owner can purchase a property subject to a zoning prohibition and has the same rights as the property owner at the time that zoning was placed upon it. So he's entitled to a variance even though the condition existed at the time that he purchased the property. I believe that is the law of the state.
Counsel, if we're going to have all these variances, what's the point of having a zoning law?
Well, that's where I want to go. Okay. Zoning was adopted in the state of Wisconsin in 1925, and in 1927, the legislature added the zoning provision that allows for variances. It was, word for word, the Standard State Zoning Enabling Act prepared by the Department of Commerce. What they recognize, you have to understand, we have zoning and we've all lived with zoning all of our lives. It's been a reality. But in 1927, zoning was a new thing. And what they realized is that if we go to a community on which no regulations have previously existed, and we set down regulations for the entire community at one time, those regulations have to be right as to every property. And I believe that they knew then that they couldn't get it right, that they would do their best, but that there would be instances in which the application of the law to individual properties would work a hardship. They knew that. I don't think there's a planner alive today that would walk in front of this body and tell you that the planning industry is capable of writing the perfect zoning ordinance, that everybody will be happy, that they thought of everything, they've looked at every parcel, they've anticipated every change in use of property in the future. We're all aware of neighborhoods that are in transition. We've all heard of the term gentrification, where neighborhoods that had been run down are now in the process of rebuilding. All of that requires that there be a degree of flexibility so that we can escape the hard workings of the law. What the legislature did in 1927 was adopt, word for word, what had been done nationally in almost every state in the union. They adopted a variance procedure. When they did that, what they said is, we're going to appoint five people locally. They're not elected officials, and their job is going to be to look at individual properties and see whether or not the specific workings of the zoning ordinance, as they relate to that property, work an unnecessary hardship. They did not define unnecessary hardship. I believe they did it by design. What they said, I'm going to read from the statute, to authorize on appeal in specific cases, not general cases, has to be unique, variances from the terms of the ordinance. What that means is the law says one thing and we're going to let you ignore the law. That's what a variance is. A special exception or a conditional use, those are permitted under the law. A variance is the right to ignore the law. That will not be contrary to the public interest. We have to take into consideration the public interest in the uniform application of zoning, but we recognize that there will be occasions where we may want to let you ignore the law. Where only the special conditions, problem has to be unique, can't be a self-imposed hardship, a literal enforcement of the provisions of the ordinance will result in unnecessary hardship. And so that the spirit of the ordinance shall be observed and substantial justice done. Those two conflict with each other. The spirit of the ordinance is what DNR would ask the court to do. We always have to enforce this ordinance because that's why we wrote it. That's why communities adopt zoning, so that they can regulate the activities and use of land. But on the other hand, they also said, and substantial justice done. And it's the substantial justice that requires that there be an ability to provide variances. For 70 years, 71 years, that was the law of the state of Wisconsin. And the case law was such that if you had a piece of property and you wanted to make a use of it that was not permitted by the zoning, if you wanted to put a factory in a residential neighborhood, it was recognized that that would change the character of the neighborhood. It was the character of the neighborhood. It was the impact on the deviation from the law on the neighborhood that was critical to whether you got the variance or not. That's why you needed five locally appointed people who would recognize, are you going to change this neighborhood or aren't you?
Right, Mr. Kastner, in accepting that argument, but listening to opposing counsel, he says, Markdale, Snyder, Winnebago, and finally Kenosha, nothing's new. Nothing's changed with... And he says that we have Markdale, which was, I think, 24 Wisconsin. It's a number of years ago that had the same language. So what is new?
Justice Wilcox, Markdale was a use variance case. A gentleman wanted to use a piece of property for use that was not permitted. The law of this state, I believe, is best set forth in the Snyder case. Snyder says there's two kinds of variances. One is a use variance, which means I want to use the property for a use that's not permitted by the ordinance. The other is an area variance. An area variance is a situation where the zoning says this is a residential lot. You can only use this property for residential purposes. It goes on to say, however, that you have to set back 25 feet from the road and 10 feet from the side yard, and maybe you need a 50-foot rear yard setback, and maybe the house can't be taller than 35 feet. But for various reasons, maybe the topography of the lot, maybe there's bedrock, maybe there's a cliff or a gully, the only way you can use that lot is to move the lot into some of those required setbacks. Or maybe because of the slope of the lot, you have to go taller than 35 feet.
Maybe you want a bigger
feet.
House.
Pardon?
Maybe you want a bigger house.
Maybe you want a bigger house. That may be a little bit more difficult. What the law says is, and what Snyder said, is that if you want to use variance, you have to show that without it, you can't make any feasible use of the property. That's the standard that the court applied in Markdale. But Markdale was a use variance case. Snyder also went on to say if you want an area variance, the standard is different. In Snyder, the standard was whether an unnecessary hardship or practical difficulty exists is best explained as whether compliance with the strict letter of the restrictions governing area setbacks, frontage, height, bulk, or density would unreasonably prevent the owner from using the property for a permitted purpose. So if he's permitted to build a house, but the restrictions would unreasonably prevent him from doing so, he can get a variance. Or if they would render conformity with the restrictions unnecessarily burdensome. What does that mean? If you have to spend $100,000 blasting bedrock or removing a cliff in order to get your house within the side yard setbacks, that might be unreasonably burdensome from a cost standpoint because the house is not going to change the character of the neighborhood. It's the character of the neighborhood that counts. Kenosha specifically rejected reference to the character of the neighborhood. It says you can't consider that. But that's why we have variances. That's why the legislature wanted this decision to be made locally, and they did not want variances to be freely given. That's why you have to pay attention to the spirit of the ordinance. Yes?
Part of your argument that you're just advancing now rests on your interpretation of Snyder. And I reread it again this morning. And I mean, tell me what's wrong with my reading of this. As I read it on page 468, looks like maybe 473. And 473 is discussing the differences between the two. Use variance, the standard had been unnecessary hardship. And then continues on 473, and area variances, the standard had been the practical difficulties. Page 474, the Snyder Court says, we think there should be no significant distinction, practical distinction, between the two terms, unnecessary hardship and practical difficulties, or unnecessary hardship. So they said there shouldn't be any difference. They're one and the same. They continue on. Next paragraph, they cite the Markdale case and said, we first took a look at this, and in Markdale, we cited a number of things, and they cite another case, older case, and for the proposition that unnecessary hardship can best be defined as a situation where in the absence of a variance, no reasonable use can be made of the land. I read those pages to say, look, there are two things. No, we think there's no significant difference between those two labels, practical distinction and unnecessary hardship. Let's define unnecessary hardship. We've done this in the past. Let's look at the 74 Harvard Law Review article. Let's look at Markdale. And then we've come up with the definition. That's the way I read those pages. Tell me why I'm reading those pages incorrectly.
Justice Bradley, you are correct in that Snyder eliminated the distinction between an unnecessary hardship and a practical difficulty. But it did not remove the distinction between the definition of an unnecessary hardship as applied to a use variance as opposed to the definition of an unnecessary hardship as applied to an area variance.
Well, what do I do with this language where it says, therefore, we think there should be no significant practical distinction between the two terms?
There was a practice from other states of saying that there was practical difficulties as applied to area variances, but there was unnecessary hardship as applied to a use variance. Yes. What the court said is they're all the same. That doesn't make any difference, but the court continued to preserve the distinction by saying that there's a different standard for unnecessary hardship as it relates to a use variance compared to when you're considering an area variance. It says it's easier to get an area variance. Because
that in the discussion that I just read. So that was in the background, it used to be considered easier to get one than the other, but it seems sensible to treat two terms as if they were synonymous, citing the law of zoning and planning. So that kind of discussion goes before what I just cited.
I agree. And then what you did is you read up to the point where the court cited to Markdale. And Markdale established the definition of a hardship in a use variance case. And you stopped. And the very next sentence starts with the definition of a hardship in relationship to an area variance. And that's the language I just read to the court a minute ago. And that is, if it's an area variance, it's not no feasible use. It's whether it would unreasonably prevent the owner from using the property for a permitted purpose, or would render conformity with such restrictions unnecessarily burdensome. And that's the part that disappears in Kenosha. That's the part that prevents me from getting a setback to put a handicap access ramp on the front of a house if I have to go into the 25-foot roadside setback.
Counsel, what kind of rule, maybe you've said it before, but why don't you repeat it for our benefits? How do you think that the court, when it writes its decision, if it adopts you or Mr. Carlson, should modify, withdraw, overrule, or whatever, Kenosha County, and establish a new standard that you think fits both the zoning and the homeowner and the Builders Association?
Chief Justice, I believe the court should overrule itself with regards to Kenosha. I believe that it should go back to Snyder. I see my time is up. May I finish the answer?
You can answer the question.
I believe that the court should go back to Snyder. It should adopt the two-tier standard that's set forth on page 474 in the Snyder.
I have a little trouble with your doing that in light of what Justice Bradley wrote, so why don't you give us what the standards are for error and for use, as you see it, and then tell us whether this is a use, area, or hybrid.
With regard to a use variance, the standard set forth in Snyder was that an unnecessary hardship can best be defined as a situation where, in the absence of a variance, no feasible use can be made of the land. Snyder predates the Lucas case, and Lucas says that you have to allow a property owner an economically beneficial or productive use. Consequently, I would rewrite the standard that appears in Snyder slightly, and I would make it read as follows. An unnecessary hardship can best be defined as a situation where, in the absence of a variance, no economically beneficial or productive use can be made of the land.
No economically beneficial or productive use. Okay.
And that's directly taken from the case of Lucas versus Carolina Coastal Commission.
Okay.
Decided by the U.S. Supreme Court.
The Department of Natural Resources is upset. They feel that their zoning is different. They would say the Board of Adjustment is terrific, but not for our stuff. They would say we would agree to a lesser standards needed, but not for our stuff. And that's that 10 years of basically that DNR position saying this is not good enough for our stuff. It's good enough for regular zoning, but it's not good enough for our stuff. When we say 75 feet, God bless it, we really mean 75 feet. When we say regional flood, not an inch less. And that's not the way zoning was looked at before, but that's the way DNR looks at it, like any other part of the regulation.
In your earlier comments, you said it wasn't just Kenosha County, but some cases beforehand, so that the last 10 years, the board moved back dark. Did I hear that correctly?
Well, there has been a series of challenges. The challenges of DNR have really arisen over the last 10 years, and they've culminated in State versus Winnebago County, State versus Kenosha, and this one. And I whether it's 10 or not, it's probably, but the 10 years has now taken its toll on the culmination of State v. Kenosha County. And I submit to you that for DNR's own benefit, that they're better off with the Board of Adjustment, just like any other zoning. And I submit to you that the legislature never intended that DNR be able to cut out the Board of Adjustment in floodplain zoning. There is no indication, as a matter of fact, just the contrary is true. The Board of Adjustment stands as it's written and it applies to floodplain just like any other thing. Now, whether you want to, we need to adjust the standard, but one size fits all for floodplain shoreland is not any more valid than one size fits all for the zoning in Bondiwell, Wisconsin.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Would
you give us the site?
Yes, Your Honor. In my brief, at pages 6 through 8, I discussed this issue. And
pages what?
6 through 8 of my supplemental brief.
Supplemental, yes. Okay.
And what I cite to the court is Section 1, Chapter 614 of the 1965 laws of Wisconsin. That would be the legislation that created the DNR. In Section 31 of that same piece of legislation, the legislature authorized the DNR to grant floodplain zoning regulations.
You know, 87.30 talks about DNR doing floodplain, but only when the county hasn't done it.
Yes, but there's also legislation that requires the counties to adopt laws which are, I mean, the counties adopt laws modeled after the state regulations. And I believe there's legislation requiring them to do that.
Thank you, Counselor.
I don't know off the top of my head. Might I clarify one point that I made, that I might have made a mistake?
If you do, why don't you send us a letter with that? It's not unusual for council to have made error in the oral argument. You would do that with council.
I won't suggest that I made error. I just wanted to clarify.
There's, council may think that he needs clarification, and you can do that by letter if you would. So send your comments to opposing counsel. Now that ends this case, and now I'm going to try and see how we can do a little crowd control here. Because the second case of this day